to the Rogue Startups Podcast, where two startup founders are sharing lessons learned and pitfalls to avoid in their online businesses. And now, here's Dave and Craig.
All right. Welcome to episode 110 of Rogue Startups. Today, we have a special guest, Josh Hainem of Interact, and he's here to talk a little bit about where his business came from and what kind of content marketing he does and just life as a co-founder in general. Josh, welcome. How are you today?
I'm doing excellent. Thank you so much for having me on.
Yeah, sure. No problem. And of course, Craig is here as well. So, Josh, why don't we start by having you tell us a little bit about Interact, what it does, how you kind of got started with it, you know, met your co-founder, all that sort of stuff?
Yeah, absolutely. So Interact is a tool for creating quizzes. And when I say that, what you think of is probably what we do. So those quizzes that are on Facebook all the time, the what kind of coffee drink are you quiz, the what kind of shrimp are you quiz, the what type of business owner are you quiz, literally that. So we sell a platform to companies who want to create quizzes like the ones that are on Facebook all the time, but it's for their brand. And the reason that it helps their brand is that quizzes have this natural virality to them. People love taking quizzes. And if you create one as a brand, you can pull people in to your world using that quiz on social media. And then our quizzes also have an optional contact form that can appear so the brand can use the quiz to acquire new contacts that they can then follow up with. And they can even segment those contacts based on how people answer quiz questions or what kind of coffee they should be drinking, that kind of stuff. So that's the tool itself. Right now, we've got about 40,000 users across our network. We have a freemium model. So across our free and paid users, including brands like the Red Cross, Forbes, Red Lobster, United Nations, Home Depot, and just a bunch of other crazy names. So it's been a wild ride. I started the company with a friend that I met in college. It's funny, I'm actually in the startup UCLA offices where we began. We met freshman year of college and then started the company together right after our second year of school. And it's been about 6 years since then. So we graduated in 2014. And this year, we've grown a lot. So from the inception of the company until the beginning of this year, we were just three people. So we hired one guy along the way there. But then this year we've grown to 10. So it's been a wild journey and we've exploded and gotten a lot more popular this year. So it's been a wild ride and lots of fun. And now we get to work with a ton of cool people. So that's what we do.
That's awesome. What do you attribute most of your growth to? I mean, that's really crazy growth. Like hockey stick kind of growth in the last year or so. What kind of changed in your business or what kind of things do you feel like you did right to enable that growth?
Yeah, so it is a hockey stick in the last few quarters. I keep putting this joke. Well, it's not a joke. It's a real graph, but it's a graph of our paying customers. And then I put a hockey stick below it. And then I just put LOL at the top of the page because they look the same. So yeah. it's a really fun time. There's a couple of things that have contributed to the growth. One of them is going back to education. So we got our initial customers by being educational, writing blog posts about how to use quizzes as a marketing tool. And there wasn't a huge audience reading those, but that's how we got our first customers because those articles were so specific. Then we kind of strayed off for a couple of years and tried to do sales, which is kind of the conventional wisdom. You know, once you get your first 100 customers, start selling. That's what we tried to do. It failed for several years. And then at the beginning of this year, I came to the realization that trying the same thing over and over again is actually the definition of stupidity. And we stopped doing that and went back to the education, but in a new way, using influencer partners. And since then, we've really sparked a lot of growth. And then the other thing, too, is that we're easily ahead of the wave, and I've only been surfing a few times, but actually being ahead of the wave, basically you get out in front of it and then it just doesn't push you because it dissipates by the time it gets to you. So now we're backing up into the wave to where people are catching on to the idea of what we do and starting to recognize that it's a useful thing. And there's more general interest in using quizzes for marketing than there ever has been, drastically more. You know, when we started, there was none. And now it's scaled up to some, which is also helping us a lot. So it's a combination of those things.
I think the term you used there a bit was like influencer marketing and partnerships with existing customers or influencers in particular niches. I think that's a really powerful thing because kind of like the virality you mentioned with quizzes themselves, this is something that kind of can build on itself and kind of exist on its own. How did you guys approach that in a systematic way? I mean, I look at it in my business and podcasting. I think it can be a similar thing where like, oh, what kind of tool to use for podcasting? Oh, we use this for hosting or we use that mic. A lot of people rely on word of mouth. How did you guys approach kind of getting into that smartly?
Yeah, so we got into it because I read an article about Adidas and how they do influencer marketing. And Adidas, even though they partner with tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of influencers, they still connect with each of them individually and do a vetting process to make sure it's somebody that they can trust to represent their brand properly. And so that's what I did. I followed that model, started reaching out to bloggers and marketing people that might want to use quizzes for marketing, and then just offering them a partnership in which they get to use our stuff and they don't have to pay for it. And then in return, they write about it and they write these tutorial posts, and then they put that in front of their audience. So it helps us expand who we reach with our educational content. And then we help them with the content as well to make sure they're writing good pieces that help other people figure out how to use quizzes. So it was a very step-by-step process, you know, finding out who we want to work with by looking at our most successful, best customers, finding people that are similar to them, reaching out to them one at a time, vetting them to make sure it's somebody that we want to represent our brand, and then going through the process of having them create an educational piece on their own blog and then publish it. So the whole thing is very manual on purpose because we really value the integrity of our brand and how we are represented. And that's why we did it that way.
Very cool. Very cool. So getting a little bit deeper into that, was that your content strategy from the get-go, or did you sort of evolve into that? Did you start off with traditional content marketing? How has your strategy changed over time?
Yeah. So the initial content strategy back in 2013, 2014, was to write blog posts on our own blog. So, you know, I had no connections. I didn't know anyone. There was none of this influencer stuff that could even happen at that point. Maybe it could have, but we weren't doing it. And so it was just writing on our own blog. And that actually got us our first few customers. And then I took that and extrapolated it out to doing guest posting. And take that back a step. I wrote several hundred blog posts. So it's not like it was just a few. It was a lot of writing about how to use quizzes in very specific niches and things like that so that we could reach exactly who we wanted to reach with that content. And then I extrapolated it out to guest posting, and I would write for all sorts of blogs, entrepreneur.com, Buffer, Kissmetrics, that kind of stuff. I did a couple hundred more blog posts for those, so guest posts. And at that point, I felt like we were reaching a limit. It was not, each post wasn't really getting us much. There was a ton of effort that went into creating them, either on our own site or especially with a guest post. It was a ton of work, and we just weren't getting a whole lot back. And that's where I made the decision to switch over to trying to do sales. And we stopped doing content marketing for a while, and the sales completely failed. And after we switched back, we were looking for a way to reach more of an audience with less effort. And that's where the influencers come into play, because we can utilize their audiences, and it's a good trade for them because they're getting access to this new free tool. It's not free for everyone, but they get to use it for free, and it's really useful for them.
That's cool. Now, I'm curious, did you guys ever try dog fooding your own service as a way to create content marketing for yourself?
You know, we have a little bit. It doesn't tend to work super well for B2B. It's mainly a B2C play, so
nobody wants to find out what kind of shrimp they are before they buy a quiz service.
All right. Yeah, it doesn't work so well for that. And we've worked with some B2B clients, some really big ones actually, but they mainly use it internally, or, you know, not really for their own marketing, just because, yeah, you can't make that leap from what kind of shrimp you are to selling a quiz service. And even if you tried to appeal to your audience, do something along the lines of what type of marketer are you, it's still a pretty obvious ploy to just collect contact information. So it's definitely a more B2C centric tool
By the way, I'm a deep fried coconut breaded shrimp myself.
Perfect. You've taken the quiz before. Nice.
Yeah. Well, I took it three times. The first time I was scampi. The second time I was that. And I don't remember the third.
That Red Lobster quiz is their most liked Facebook post in the history of the company. It has 177,000 likes on it.
Wow.
Oh my God. I'm trying to, so this sort of leads me to another question. I knew you were about to ask something, Craig. I'm going to jump in anyway.
No, wear it out, man. Yeah.
Yeah. So what is it? What's the psychology behind quizzes? Why are they so naturally viral? What is it that everybody loves about them so much and makes them want to share them? Because they don't do the same thing with like blog posts or epic content posts or educational stuff. What is it? What's special about quizzes?
Yeah. Let me tell you, and I'll put it into a picture because I have the perfect picture of this from last week. So the reason that we like them is because we get to talk about ourselves. And getting to talk about yourself is a natural and extremely powerful draw. And the picture that I have of this is that last Friday, I was actually at my sister's elementary school. She's a school teacher. And I was working with K through sixth graders, basically for their career day, talking to them about careers in technology. And most of the stuff goes straight over their head, right? You start talking about what a CEO is and technology and websites, and they're just actually walking around in circles around the table. They're pulling their hair out. They're, you know, slapping each other and messing around. And then you turn on a quiz and you say, who wants to take a quiz and answer questions about what your favorite breakfast is and your favorite flavor? Those kids got pulled in. They were leaning over the table, looking at the laptop. They were raising their hands to vote. They were cheering when they wanted to vote. There was a firefighter and a police officer who also had tables, and they were nowhere near as popular as mine with the quiz. Actually, at the end of the day, the firefighter was like, I need to go get a drink. And that was rough. And I was like, man.
Boom! In your face, firefighters. I just public got it all over their best you, man.
Right there.
It was like, in what world is the IT guy the cool guy at the career fair when you've got a firefighter and a police officer? And it blew me away. These quizzes, and it's the same thing. We've had quizzes done. We did one with Jiffy Lube, and the average quiz taker was a 65-year-old man. And there was 200 comments on their Facebook ad with these guys fighting about which classic car they were. And it has no bounds. People just love to answer questions that are about themselves. And it pulls them in such a crazy, visceral way that we will never get over. And, you know, that story from the elementary school, just, I'm never going to forget that. It was crazy to see these kids who pay attention to nothing all of a sudden just be completely enthralled with this thing for 3 or 4 minutes as we're going through and voting on which ones they like the best. It's crazy.
So your customers are using this mostly as like a lead gen tool, right? What are some of the best practices that you see your customers employ to kind of take and do something with the results that they get from that right on the back of someone completing a quiz?
Yeah. So we have integrations with all of the marketing automation programs. So basically what you can do is you can have follow-up sequences for each of the quiz outcomes. So if you're doing a what type of coffee are you and you've got light, medium, and dark roast, you can have a follow-up sequence for light roast, medium roast, and dark roast. You can also tag people based on how they answer individual questions. So if one of those questions is what's your favorite morning drink and you happen to also sell orange juice for some reason, then if they answer orange juice, you can send them an email with an orange juice coupon. So you can use really specific data. But the best practice for following up is to follow a sequence of emails that reference the person's quiz result. So you'd say in your first email, hey, it looks like you're a light roast. Let me tell you more about being light roast and how light roast is made and the history and all that kind of stuff. And then your second email that you send out, it says, hey, you're light roast, but here's the other options you could have gotten. And then you talk about medium roast and dark roast. And then in the third email, you say, here's how you should prepare your light roast. And you give 3 tips for preparing the best light roast. And all of this is assuming that you sell coffee beans, because each of your emails is going to have links to buy light roast, obviously.
Right.
So Your third email is tips. And then your fourth email is a coupon. So you'd say, hey, we've been talking about Light Roast for quite a long time now. Check out this coupon to get 25% off your first order. Click here to buy now. So you have a follow-up sequence that references exactly what they got, because a quiz is very memorable, specifically because you talk about yourself in it and then you're seeing your results. People don't forget. So you can use the fact that they remember it to follow up and reference the quiz result that they got and have people buy things from you.
So that raises a question in my mind here. You talked about, you know, this specific e-commerce business. So I'm in e-commerce with Recapture email marketing, and that sort of tickled my fancy there a little bit. Who would you say are some of your ideal customers? Like, who would be the right person to get the most out of a quiz-based business here? Is it strictly commerce, or what kinds of customer niches do you actually see?
Yeah, so there's a few that work really, really well. So commerce works well because you can sell things directly through the quiz. You can give personalized recommendations. You can basically become a miniature version of Amazon, where they've got all this data and they're showing you personalized recommendations using a quiz. You can spin that up really easily and quickly. So that one works well. The other industry that works really well is in any sort of online content that you're selling. So courses, ebooks, that kind of stuff, because it's a similar play where you can use somebody's personality to then sell them more products or different courses, stuff like that. So anything where, and those are the top two industries, so retail and any sort of online content that is for sale. And the reason those work well is because everything is done online and you use a lot of email in general. You can put people onto the right drip campaigns depending on which outcome they get. You can use all that personalization stuff super easily and then plug in your products really quickly to get the most out of it. So those are the top two industries.
So Josh, you mentioned that B2B doesn't work that well, and both the examples you gave are both kind of B2C. Why do you think that is? And kind of maybe like, what opportunities do you see for real B2B companies with this kind of marketing tool?
Yeah, so I think the thing with B2B is that it's tough to get directly to the buyer. I think a lot of times B2B purchases happen in a very convoluted sequence. So one person sees it, they forward it to someone else, they forward it to someone else. It ends up being a decision that's made through a team, or there's a boss that's making the decision. So you don't have this one person who you can play into who they are in order to make the sale. You kind of have to work at it from a lot of different angles. And that's why it's really hard to have a quiz work, because if the champion takes the quiz, you know, if you have your champion buyer that's really gung-ho about your product, it's not going to translate over to the boss who's actually making the purchasing decision. So it's really hard when you don't have one person who actually has all the power, which is often the case in a B2B sale. And that's why it's tough. The way that you can make it work is basically by following the same principles as you would if you're making a B2C quiz, where you're asking people questions that they want to answer. That's how you're drawing them in. You get them all fired up about the quiz and the results and what it says about them, that kind of stuff. And then you hope that that's enough momentum to propel you through. But oftentimes that momentum dissipates when it runs into somebody else who hasn't taken the quiz that you're also trying to convince to buy your product. And that's where it can struggle.
So I'd like to dig in a little bit to find out about your marketing success here, because you've got this great hockey stick growth that you've talked about here. So obviously at some point you found a marketing channel that worked, you dialed it in hard, and you know, the hockey stick just started happening. So my question is, what's the big marketing channel that you find that is working for you? How did you end up finding it? And what other channels did you try? And like, how long did you stick with them before deciding that they weren't working? The reason I kind of want to know about all of that is that I know that there's, you know, a constant struggle with Craig and me personally and others in our audience of finding that channel. How long do you stick with it before you say, oh God, this thing's just a piece of shit, it's not working? And like, how deep do you go? How much do you spend before you get to that point? So I'm just curious as to how you did that with Interact.
Yeah. So I can talk to this because I've messed it up a lot. So basically, we tried a bunch of things, and the first thing that we tried was direct email outreach, which completely failed. I sent thousands of emails between the middle of 2013 and 2014, and no one responded because no one had even heard of quizzes for marketing at that point. This was before even BuzzFeed was doing quizzes, and it was before anybody was doing quizzes. And the responses, if I did get them, were, "You mean like school?" was the response. And that just was a total, total failure. So that didn't work. It was the first thing we tried. Second thing we tried was content marketing, as you would read about content marketing on a content marketing blog. And what I mean is a bunch of these roundup posts and 99 resources for making a better blog and all this random stuff that has nothing to do with what we actually do, which is quizzes for marketing. And that also didn't work to get us any customers. It did drive traffic and we got some backlinks from it, which I think was pivotal to the third thing that we tried, which was actually really specific educational content on how to use quizzes for marketing in very specific use cases and very specific industries. And those articles did get us some signups, but there was very, very few people searching for them. So it was a few signups here and there. But because it was so related to what we were doing, anybody who was reading those articles came and signed up for our product. So that was the third thing that we did, which finally got us off the ground in terms of paying customers. Then the fourth thing that we did was the guest posting, which was similar types of content about very specific marketing things on other people's marketing blogs. That also sort of worked, but again, it was a small audience. The articles didn't always do that well because it was just such a new concept that it wasn't super shareable or anything. So that was the fourth thing we tried. Then the fifth thing that we tried was stupid, and it was going back to email outreach, which I don't know why I did that because it obviously didn't work the first time.
And hey, it just felt like you were smarter, right? You felt, okay, yeah. Well, I know so much more at this point. Maybe I'll give it another shot. Maybe I just didn't do it right the first time.
You know, that was actually the rationalization. And it was, hey, we're smarter, / we've grown a little bit so we can hire somebody to do this. That didn't work. So then we had to fire that person. Then I thought, okay, I'm getting smarter again. I'll hire somebody else. That also didn't work. Had to fire that person. Three times. It's like, how long are you going to freaking try this before you realize this is just stupid and this has never worked? And even when you tried this back in the day, it didn't work. Why would it work now? So three times over 2+ years, we tried the sales thing. And part of the reason for continuing to try that as well was that everybody that I met with asking for advice was saying, you know, sales cures all. Just sell more. Just sell, sell, sell. And then I'd go look up how to sell, or I'd talk to people about how to sell, and they'd say, okay, you know, spin up these email outreach campaigns, all that kind of stuff. And, you know, we just kept trying it and kept rationalizing it by saying we're getting better, all that kind of stuff. And it just never worked.
Hey, Josh, how long on kind of each of those did you give each approach? I mean, is it weeks or months and dollars? Like, what was the barometer there?
Yeah. Okay. So if we go back through, I think we're at stage 5 now. So if we go back to stage 1, which was email outreach the first time, spent just about 7 months, I'd say, doing that primarily, and sent a few thousand emails. They were all personalized. That didn't work. Didn't really spend money on it other than whatever my time was worth at that point. I was still in school. So
not very much.
So that was the first thing. Then the content marketing, the Broadway was the second stage. That lasted about 5 months and didn't spend any money on it. Made some good connections, just trying to learn and stuff like that. So it was useful. But again, 5 months, nothing really came out of it. Then the stuff where we were doing really specific articles, that started as the third thing, and we've kind of kept doing it to some extent because it does work since then. So it's hard to say when that stopped. It stopped as the main strategy when we started doing sales. So that would have been about a year that we did it before it was no longer the main thing. Guest blogging was the second half of that year. So the first 6 months was mainly just on our blog. Second 6 months was both guest blogging and our own. Now we're on to the fifth stage with the sales. And that one, unfortunately, was just over 2 years. And between tools and people that we hired and then had to, unfortunately, get rid of because it was just the wrong strategy, we probably spent, gosh, at least $100,000, maybe, wow, maybe 200, close to 200, yeah, I would say.
Ouch.
So yeah, that was rough. That was rough. And a lot of that was supported by me kind of doing essentially consulting within our own brand. So consulting for brands that wanted to use our product or wanted somebody to do it all for them and that kind of stuff, which is just a bear of a job. It's, mm-hmm, it's terrible. Just get beat over the head with a club all day long. So that was really tough to be propping up this thing that was the wrong strategy by doing really, really tough menial labor for people. So that was stage five. And then stage six, which is what finally worked, was the influencer outreach and having them publish the same blog posts as stage three, which was the educational content that we were doing on our blog. So they were doing the same exact kind of content, but it went out to their audience. And so we reached new people with that kind of content. And that is what has propelled all of our growth this year. And at this point, we've been doing it for 10 months. And we have one full-time gal that's doing it and three interns that are working on it. And then I jump in from time to time. So it's becoming a much bigger part of what we do.
Yeah. You mentioned before that it's a really systematic, very manual approach. You have someone full-time doing it now and some interns. Can you talk a little bit about, like, I guess, from the beginning and how that process has evolved? But, like, say we want to start influencer outreach and marketing. What's kind of the framework that you use to say, okay, you want to start? Here's how you identify the people to go for at first. Here's your, like, how to identify your ideal person. And then how do you get them kind of on the hook and follow through and have them actually write the post and send it to their email list and all that kind of stuff?
Yeah. It's really a good question because it's something that we've been looking to solidify on our end. Cause at the beginning, a lot of it was just kind of spray and pray, just go for it and we'll see what happens. But now we're actually formulating the process because our hope is to replicate it and have, you know, we have this team of three or four that's working on it and we're hoping to duplicate that and then have that be a team of six or eight and have kind of two squads that are doing the same thing because we want to make sure the results are doubled. So basically the way it works is you want to identify who you need to connect with. And the way we did that was looking at our customers and who was the most engaged, and then figuring out of the people that were the most engaged, do any of them have blogs? Because they need to be writing already. Otherwise, they're not going to just write about you on their SaaS product website. It just would make no sense. So you got to figure out who's already talking about your industry. And then out of that subset, who is actually using your product? So we identified that marketing bloggers and marketing consultants and brand strategists are all kind of in that, between those two circles. And that's who we want to connect with. So I identified that. Then we wrote down a list of attributes and things to look for in terms of what those sites look like and how to find them. Then we go out and we find them. Then we send an email that basically outlines the offer really simply, just no strings attached. This is what we're giving you. This is what we would like in return. You don't have to write a post. Obviously, if you use this and it just totally sucks for you, we're not going to force you to write something. And that's the deal that we have to offer. If they're interested, we jump it over to a quick phone call just because we've found the power of actually having a quick conversation, even if it's only 10 minutes, is huge. It makes a massive difference. So a quick phone call. Then we schedule sometimes for them to use the product. So when will you have used it? Send us an email if you have feedback. And then we schedule another time for them to publish a blog post. We schedule those onto a calendar. And then we really leave it up to them. If they use it and they like it, then they'll follow through. If they don't for some reason, then we don't push the issue. We just let them go. We're not going to force anybody to do anything they don't want to. And that's pretty much the process from front to back. And we just replicate that a bunch of times.
For the first part of finding which users are kind of engaging with your product most, do you use like NPS for that to get a tangible number there? Or is that just kind of a gut feeling?
We don't use NPS at this point. We use Intercom, which shows us how engaged people are. And then we can also, once we get in contact with those people, we'll ask them and do a survey through a phone, basically a phone survey of how things are actually going for them. So we don't use a tool per se for NPS, but it's a roundabout way of getting the same concept.
Gotcha. And in Intercom, what are you looking at there for engagement?
Basically, logins over time. So if you're using our product a lot and you're actually tracking the results and things like that, you're going to be logging in. Yep. And so we look at, you know, how often people are logging in.
Right on.
Was it any different when you first started? Because, you know, until you guys kind of got to be more well known as Interact the Quiz Guys, you know, and you reached out to influencers, did they just sort of go, eh, you know, because they didn't really know who you were? Or were they just, you know, because they were so engaged with the product, they were like, oh yeah, I'm totally on board with this. They didn't really care. I mean, was there any sort of did you have to influence the influencer, I guess is what I'm asking here?
Yeah. So that's a really interesting one as well, because we actually found that unless people were already interested in the concept of doing quizzes, which is why it's important for us to have kind of waited out until the market decided they like quizzes, unless somebody already has the concept in their mind, they're not going to work with us, because we can't introduce the concept of quizzes and how that works and why it's useful and then also try to ask them to partner with us. That's two things and we can only do one. So when we reach out to somebody, we just try to make it very clear that we're not asking them to buy something. We're not asking them to commit to anything. We simply have a solution for doing marketing quizzes. And if they respond and say, hey, you know, I've already been thinking about quizzes, this sounds cool, that's a perfect partner for us. Otherwise, we just move on to the next one. So we're just trying to find all the people that have already decided that quizzes are interesting to them and partner with them. And then hopefully, as we go back around and loop back to people a year from now, that group will be larger and larger and larger, and we can go through and kind of skim off the top.
Cool, cool. So to get back and into the real kind of business of it a little bit, Dave and I talked about SaaS metrics and specifically churn. Oh, Dave, what, 10 or 15 episodes ago? We talked about it a
something
lot
like
recently.
That.
As you guys have an interesting business model where you're a B2B company, but then your customers are all B2C, right? So I think that's a little bit interesting. But mm-hmm. but in terms of like SaaS metrics, what's been kind of the biggest headache for you guys? And then like what's your, we call it a North Star metric, like the one thing that you say, like, this is a good day or a good month or not?
Yeah. So I think there's a few headaches. The two biggest ones are churn as well as just new trial signups. And, you know, new trial signups are connected directly to marketing. And that's where it was a struggle for a long time to find that channel that we could actually control the new trial signup lever. We never could until we found this influencer marketing thing. And then churn is also tough because this is such a new thing. So our biggest problem is that people hear about it, they get excited about it, and then they don't follow through and use it because they're not seeing it everywhere yet. They're not seeing it on all of their friends' websites, and they don't see all these examples of, oh, that's how I should use this. And so they get lost. And when we are looking at metrics, There's really two that need to be in conjunction. We need our new trial signups to be increasing. And right now we're getting 10% growth on that month over month, which is pretty amazing. And that's what we want to keep. It's not going to last forever. There's no way. But that is kind of the North Star on that one. And then in terms of churn, our goal there, which we've also been hitting, is 5% monthly churn, which is in the marketing space, kind of standard. It's what Buffer and ConvertKit, which both publish their metrics, it's what they both have. And it's just part of what happens when you have a newer tool. So those are our two metrics, 10% month over month, top line revenue growth, which comes from the new trials, and then 5% churn.
Can I ask just one follow-up part of that? And it's just in terms of like business structure. You guys have a free tier, right?
Correct, yeah.
How is that dynamic and like conversions to paid, just kind of your thoughts on having a free plan?
Yeah. So the thing with the free plan is that the way we look at it is people need a lot of time to decide to do something new. And it's a really interesting problem because there's very few SaaS companies that do anything new. Like there's a lot of new email marketing programs, but they're not inventing email marketing. They're not the first one.
Yeah.
And I listened to a really good talk by the gal that started Constant Contact, because they were one of the first ones. And it took them something like 3 years to get their first 100 paying subscribers. And we're pretty much in the same kind of world that they were, where we're the first ones doing quiz marketing. So we have this unique struggle here where we have to wait on a lot of things and we have to be really patient with a lot of stuff. And so it is hard in that sense, but that is the one thing we have to worry about.
So I think our final question here sort of is more around the dynamics of your business between you and your co-founder here. So a lot of the, you know, Craig and I are single founders. We work by ourselves a lot. So we're lord and master of our domain, so to speak. And if there's a decision to be made or, you know, some hard choice or some consequence, you know, it all comes back on your shoulders here. So I'd like to hear a little bit about, you know, how have you and your co-founder gotten along over the years here? And, you know, has it always been, you know, sunshine and roses, or did you have some learning along the way? And are you, you know, still hip on, you know, sticking with co-founders these days? Or if you started another business, would you change that? Or, you know, maybe your co-founder's never going to listen to this podcast.
This is your chance.
This is your chance. I don't know. Yeah.
Well, first of all, hi Matt. I'll send this to you. So Matt and I became friends our freshman year of college, driving to Fall Retreat, which is part of Campus Crusade. It's the Christian group that we both joined our first quarter. And we bonded over both knowing the lyrics to an Eminem song. So it's pretty much been perfect since then. But no, it's...
okay,
no,
so there you
not.
Have it. There's
no,
your,
it's not.
There's your, yeah, there's your tip
yeah.
right there.
Yeah.
Bond over Eminem and go to a retreat. That's it.
Perfect. So I would say, you know, we were friends first and we were in Bible study together for a couple of years before we even started working together, which was really important because what it does is that anytime things do get really tough or you do have something really important to talk about or there's just a genuine struggle, whether it's between co-founders or it's about the business in general, it's really nice to have that to fall back on because you can really quickly revert to, hey, I care about you as my friend and I care about you as a person. We're brothers. And also there's this really hard thing that we need to talk about. And so it's super, super nice to have that always right there. Just one step back to like, okay, let's drop everything about the business real quick and just talk as friends and as people that care about each other. And I think that's super important because if you let the stuff overwhelm you and become the most important thing, then you'll lose that. And all of a sudden, you're not thinking about them as a person. You're not thinking about them as a friend. And you can do hurtful things. And I've been guilty of that over the years where I let it become too important. I let it overwhelm me. Let it become too much. And those are the times where things do become hurtful. And I think the way to prevent that from happening is to have continual, honest conversations, which is much harder than it sounds. Even if you are working with somebody every single day, actually kind of dropping whatever it is that's the issue of the hour and talking about the hard stuff that's bothering you or that is a challenge to you or that you're not liking about how things are operating, even if it has to do directly with that person, with Matt or with I, then you have to continually force yourself to have those conversations. And it gets easier over time to where bringing something up that might have been a big deal before no longer is. And it might be something really important, but it's not hard to bring it up. And it's super important to get those out of the way so that there's not these things building up that are preventing you from having that genuine connection and full trust.
That's some fantastic advice. That's great. That's great.
Yeah. Josh, I think that's a great place to wrap it up for us. Is there a place where the listeners can find out more about you and your business and kind of learn what you guys are up to?
Yeah, definitely. So I primarily use LinkedIn for connecting with people. So I'm on LinkedIn as Josh Hanum. There's actually only one Josh Hanum in the world. So it's a real easy thing to search for. And then my website is tryinteract.com. That's the quiz tool. and you can check it out there.
Awesome. Josh, thanks so much. You laid down some awesome knowledge today. I really appreciate it. I think everyone will get a lot out of it. So thanks for coming on the show.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Rogue Startups. If you haven't already, head over to iTunes and leave a rating and review for the show. For show notes from each episode and a few extra resources to help you along your journey, head over to roguestartups.com to learn more.